Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
I first came across Neil Ford about a year ago. I saw one of his videos on LinkedIn and I was hooked. Since then, I light up every time I see the distinctive black backdrop with his smiling face inviting me in for another immersive life lesson. Neil is a storyteller. He shares beautiful, heartwarming stories, always with a powerful takeaway. And in an age where many of our political leaders and media personalities encourage us to think the worst of each other and to focus on the rage, Neil highlights the best of us. Through his stories, he inspires the best of us. Neil's background is in advertising and marketing, 30 years spent creating award-winning campaigns for global power brands like Budweiser, Sony, and Nokia. For his work on Toyota, Neil ranked among the top 10 most awarded creative directors in the world in 2002. And as the author of an innovative talent development series, he was named Worldwide Director of Creative Learning for Saatchi & Saatchi. He has consulted on creative messaging for Fortune 500 companies and universities and been featured as a speaker at TEDx conferences. Most recently, Neil has gained a sudden following on social media for these inspirational videos that I've just told you about. So today, I am so excited to introduce you to Neil. This episode is filled with stories and insightful nuggets of gold. Ultimately, the message that rises up is the immense power of stories to connect us in an increasingly disconnected world and to build trust and to inspire the best from us. Enjoy. Neil, welcome to the For Love and Money podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
I'm super excited to get into our interview. I've been following you on LinkedIn and your stories are the highlight of my morning when I come into LinkedIn. And I think they have such power. So first question I want to ask you is, when you think about business, when you think about purpose in business, do you think love has a role to play?
There's a quote from Theodore Roosevelt, who I think was our 17th president. And he said, famously, in the age of robber barons and the trusts, he said that if you educate men in business, but not in ethics, you have only created a menace to society. And there was a time in the age when people knew what noblesse oblige meant, which was that if you were a ruling potentate or an emperor, you were expected to take care of the people that whom you ruled over. And I believe that we have lost very much of that in our current day, where for whatever reason that is inexplicable to me, a certain level of cruelty of management seems to be not only accepted, but celebrated in a kind of strange way. If you cannot conduct business in such a way that people love being there, you really will never be able to provide a service or a product at its optimum, at its finest expression. Great chefs cook with love. Great artists cook either with love or pain, but they are expressing something that is to be felt in the emotions. And there's a reason why art and music and food and dance, these things persist despite not having necessarily big profits. It's because what drives human beings is often emotions. And I'm staggered at how quickly business leaders abandon this in the pursuit of power and wealth, that not realizing the gain to be had, the profit, so to speak, in having an emotional relationship with your customers and clients.
Wow. Yes, you are speaking my language 100%. Business didn't start that way, did it? You know, when you think about Unilever,
trade.
Yeah, but it was also about looking after your people. It didn't sacrifice people at the altar of profit. And and it didn't cut corners for customers at the altar of profit. That came later. So this current day, I think, is huge. And then the other theme that you spoke about just then is, you know, emotions and the payoff of the emotional investment of people, you know, in what you're doing and what you're trying to achieve in an organization is unbelievable. And, you know, I think we've all of us have too readily accepted this idea that work is meant to be painful. You know, work is a slog. Work is something you got to do so you can enjoy your life and weekends outside of work, right? But who made the rules that that should be the case? Someone put it as the organizing principle of the modern world is based on pain. You know, we solve pain points. We crazy, isn't it? Because it's like the other side of that is pleasure and joy and excitement, and tap into that and wow. So those are two themes I'm really.
Yeah, an experience that I had with a very, very successful car dealer. This is an incredibly wealthy man. What characterizes him are sort of three attributes. The first is a fun-loving spirit. He never lost it. He's still a kid. And because he's a kid, he wants to share. He's not a dour curmudgeon who finds things like emotion, where he finds them frivolous and extraneous, and instead he runs through life, he kind of skips through life in a way where isn't this cool. And okay, so another of his characteristics is that he has a philosophy of I'll lose a little money to make a friend. And of course this has led to millions, because in his graciousness, in his generosity, in his abundance of feeling, he so loves his employees that they pass that out into the world. Any organization is a reflection of the top woman or top man. It's just a shadow they cast. And when you can tell a lot about a company by when the leader of the company walks into a room, are people energized? Like, they can't wait to tell that person about things they've done, or are they hiding? Do they have a low profile and think, oh my God, here comes this capricious son of a bitch. I can't wait to find myself a hiding spot. Well, when this guy would walk into a room of his own people, the energy level would increase, the noise level would go up. And of course, this was how they then thought they were supposed to approach the world. He and I were down in the Bahamas at one of these incredibly ritzy resorts. I wasn't paying, but my agency was paying for us to be there. So I was covering the bills because he was the client and I was the agency. We get to breakfast, and the breakfast is it's ludicrously simple. I think it was eggs and bacon and toast and maybe a cup of coffee. And I think it came to something like $75. And this was a decade ago. So I picked up the check and he saw me involuntarily flinch. And he knew why I was doing that. I was just going like, what is it, $100 for some bacon and eggs? And I said, yeah, basically. And he goes, tell the truth, we'd be having more fun if we were eating pizza off the hood of my car. And I thought, that is just so you. And first of all, you're right. But second, he didn't need the money to be happy. The money was something else entirely. I could go on and on. I won't, because you send me down a rabbit hole, I'll tell you the whole man's life story. But it was that one gesture where he said, tell the truth, we'd be having more fun eating pizza off the hood of my car. And what I took that to be a grand compliment, because what he was saying is, you and I both recognize that this spending this kind of money is the stupidest thing you could do.
Yeah.
Like, what is the point of this? What is the point of this excess? And whether you are a veterinarian or a plumber or an ad person or a writer, everything, you have the opportunity to go in the world and spread joy and revel in it being reflected back at you. And can I just say something about brands? You know, brands make a big deal out of talking about themselves and talking about their products, but they communicate much more by how they behave in the world, by how they move through the world. And a brand is determined as much by what they won't do as what they do. And I'll give you some sense of that. There was a Tylenol recall in the United States. I think it would have been about the sort of mid-80s, maybe late 80s. Tylenol in the city of Chicago, some jerk had put cyanide in some of the things. And it literally was a stock play. He was going to buy a bunch of the stock when it went down, or I think he'd sold short or something. Talk about cynical. He was willing to have people killed so that he could profit from this. Okay. Now, what happened was that the FBI got involved, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and they determined that it was isolated to Chicago. So they went to the management of Johnson & Johnson, the company that made Tylenol, and they said, well, the good news is that you don't have to recall the product off the shelves anywhere outside of the Chicagoland area, because we feel 99.9% sure it's isolated to this single dude. And Johnson & Johnson had a big meeting where they said, yes, but there are things we will never do. And one thing we will never do is risk, even if it's 0.01%, we won't take that risk. Because if you're wrong, people will never be able to trust us again. So it cost them tens of millions to issue a recall. But you know what happened to the stock afterwards? It skyrocketed. Because everybody understood, all the investors understood, oh, they actually live by their principles, which means that you can believe them in the earnings call, which means that you can believe them when they launch a new product and when they make a claim. And Wall Street understands trust is the most valuable commodity of any brand's weapons, and they earned it. And of course, from there, they just took off. Now, that to me was a really good example of a brand communicates by what they won't do. And when you talk about love as an important ingredient in the workplace, Carolyn, you have, no, you do know how smart that is, but that it's a brilliant tactical and tangible realism. It's a reality. And that is, companies that love their employees get employees who love their clients. A hotel, a restaurant, a mechanic. If you love the people that are walking through the door, they feel it. I guarantee you they feel it. I was in this small hotel in Plano, Texas. There's a very fancy Marriott there. It's really nice, but they were oversold and I couldn't get in. So they shunted me down the road to this little garden suites thing. It's another Marriott property, but it's a real step down. It's budget, okay? But the gal that greeted me when I walked in, this African-American gal, she was so full of life and she wanted to know my story. And I was there for about 3 days. And every day I would take one of those Lime scooters. I don't know if you have them.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. So I'd take one of these Lime scooters from the office to the hotel because it was close enough to do on one of those things. And what the principle of the Lime scooters, well, you're going to leave it here and then somebody's going to snatch it and take it away and go off somewhere else. So in other words, it won't be waiting for me in the morning. Well, she saw that I had done it two nights in a row. And the third morning I came out and it was waiting for me because she had dragged it into the hotel that nobody could snatch it. She did that just for me. So when I went to Plano, Texas, like, I don't want to stay at the Marriott. I don't care how nice the beds are.
God, Sandra, it makes such a difference, doesn't it?
It makes all the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And that trust that you talk about, Neil, it's just as important to the employees of an organization as 100%. It is to customers. You know, it's, I think sometimes people think, yeah, it's more important. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, customers know, or they've been educated that, you know, the customer is always right. And, you know, somebody can throw a tiz and the next thing you know, you're giving them a free meal, even though they don't deserve it. But if you stand by your people, then they will act with initiative with customers. And you don't have to give them policies. They'll simply behave according to how you treat them. And no doubt, I don't doubt that Sandra's boss or regional manager, whoever it is a rambunctious, playful child. And they're all like that, although maybe not. She was terrific. She used to put this thing up at the desk and she would only do it for certain customers, I know, because I wouldn't see it there all the time. It was a spinning wheel. It was a big wheel. It was a prize wheel. And when I came in, she would yank the prize wheel up on the counter and say, spin it for a prize. And it would be things like a cup of noodles or you know, a free nail clipper or something. She was just doing it to be goofball. And it was, and then, of course, here's what happens. So I'm there in the morning and I'm checking out that morning. And so Sandra says, oh, you got to spin the wheel before you go. So I spin the wheel and I think I won like a Snickers bar. And somebody else said, do I get to spin the wheel? And she said, are you going to earn it? And they said, what do you mean? And she says, are you going to smile for me? And so they give her a big smile and then she lets them spin the wheel. Come on. She just made another friend.
Yeah.
And she lost a little money on the cup of noodles.
Yeah.
But she made a friend and they're not going to the Marriott down the street, which is $300 a night. They're staying at the Garden Suites for $1.25 and having a much better time. And you know what else happens, of course, is that the guests, we all feel like we're in on it. We all feel like we're in on something. And when you feel that way, like you've got a secret, that's money.
100%. I say this, our listeners will probably be sick of hearing me say this, but maybe not. Seth Godin, people like us do things like this.
Yeah,
you know, you such a powerful phrase. And, you know, if you could skew that a little bit to people like us believe things like this. And then what you've just said, people like us know things like this. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
I've got another version of that, Seth Godin. My version of it is life gets so much easier when people like you.
Mm.
And what she does is she just by instinct, she likes to make friends. And so what happens is we like her. And when we like her, we don't complain about things. Like, I'll give you a great example. This actually happened. I didn't even think of it until we started talking about it. My shower was busted in my room. Now, here's how it might have been. I might have called down and complained, right? That's the word. I would have complained about my shower. What did I do instead? I went downstairs and said, hey, Sandra, the shower head doesn't work in my room. And she had it fixed lickety-split. But you see the difference. If she's treating me like a friend, then I'm going to treat her like a friend. And I don't call down with the complaint. I go down and tell her sweetly. And I didn't even realize I had done that until just now.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And to show up like Sandra did, right? It does take some courage because you know that there are going to be some customers, some clients who don't want that kind of, they don't want that interaction. And the reason I highlight that is because I think it's just as important to know who are not your people.
Right.
Because when you're clear on who are not your people and you get even clearer on who are your people, and it helps you have the courage to actually show up, you know,
there's a term,
for them.
There's a term that African-Americans use in the States. They call it code switching. And it's when you use a white voice at the office and a black voice with your friends. And that code switching, I have no doubt that Sandra would code switch depending on who walked in the door.
Yeah.
So she'll give you her rambunctious self first. And then when it turns out you're just tired and you don't want to talk, she'll code switch into the very efficient front desk person. Great, great Uber drivers are like that. You know, great taxi people. They'll suss you out and figure out whether you want to talk.
Yeah. 100%. Oh, okay. This just keep the stories flowing, Neil, right? Yeah. That's what you're here for. But I want to understand a little bit about your backstory, but just to, you know, in terms of how it brought you to do what you're doing today, but just to give our listeners some context, can you just briefly frame what you're doing today through StoryFire? And through how you show up. And we'll go deeper into that a little bit later.
I spent 30 years in advertising, or as they say, south of the border, propaganda. And I was lucky enough to have sort of found my niche, which was I wasn't the great genius at coming up with the ideas, but I had a knack for being able to explain the ideas. So I was often put in front of the clients to try to sell creative concepts. And I did thousands and thousands of presentations like this, developing a kind of, honing a skill. And over time, I was given the position of the worldwide head of creative education at Saatchi & Saatchi. And so it was, which is just a kind of a management training program. But what it specialized in was the art of persuasion with clients, because so often we thought in advertising, just like every other business, that, oh, the product will sell on its own merits. They will see the genius of it. All I have to do is describe it. Woo, not so much. If everybody knew a good idea when they saw it, then we would see nothing but hit movies. Like, there would never be a bad movie or a terrible song. People don't know a good idea even when it's sitting right in front of them. They have to have it explained to them. They have to have it brought to life. Almost all of the decisions we make in the world, we think we're being so objective. We think we're paying close attention to the qualities and attributes, the product features and benefits, when the truth is that we are very emotional creatures with competing emotions and motives. And sometimes we don't even know what we think. And in those cases, what is absolutely essential is for a brand or a person to communicate, I understand you. I see you. I feel what you feel. And because of this, I can be trusted to provide you with what you need. And when somebody feels seen and recognized, do they have the Barbie movie in Australia? Is that playing?
Of course we do. Margot Robbie. Homegrown.
What am I thinking? I'm so sorry. That was an... I apologize for that faux pas. Okay. Barbie is a very, very big hit, not because it's about a plastic doll that everybody played with as children. It's a gigantic runaway train because of an insight at its core about what it is to be a woman in the modern world. That movie sees you as a woman. It expresses things that you have felt but never been quite able to put to words. And then they do that marvelous soliloquy. What is the name of that wonderful Latina actress?
America Ferrera.
Right. She has that soliloquy in it where she's talking about all the things that a woman has to do but not do. But do this, but don't do that. And the movie was a delivery system for that speech in the same way that a cigarette is just a delivery system for nicotine. That was what Greta Gerwig really wanted to say. That's why she made that movie. Well, that is like everybody else. I give you this marvelous tale. I dress it up in something entertaining and funny and touching and colorful and vivacious. But at its core, I'm giving you a gift of being understood. And great brands really understand that it's not my job to sell you the features and benefits. It's my job to make you understand that I love you and that I care about you. And that's why I do what I do. I have a mechanic that fixes my Toyota. I love this guy. I love this guy. Twice I have gone in there and he has fixed the car, but it was under a certain price. And he goes, you'll get it next time. I'll get you next time. And it's like, why would I ever go anywhere else? You know, he just kind of shook it out of his sleeve. I was bang, bang, boom. I took care of it. It was no big deal. I just put it up on the jack and it turned out not to be any big deal. But don't even worry about it. Well, you know, that means that when he comes to me with a $1,300 bill on a replacement of blah, 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 it's like, okay, well, Frank says they got to pay it. So, you know, he doesn't get a hard time. You know how efficient that is? Do you know how much time and emotional energy that saves for both of us?
That's it. Right? Relationships, right? It's about
relationships are the answer to everything.
And it's how business started.
Right. In its most primal. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square meter of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square meters by 2025.
Now, hang on. We went down a rabbit hole and you didn't answer the question.
Yeah. So anyway, yes, I was I spent 30 years in advertising, and essentially what I learned to do was I learned to present things in a way where people were intrigued enough to go ahead and do them. And I now take these lessons to help individuals and small businesses and, well, large businesses for that matter. I have a lot of hedge funds coming to me.
Wow.
But what they want to be able to do is it has to be about more than the objective performance. That I need an unfair advantage. I need people to walk in hoping that I'm going to persuade them. And there is a trick to that, and that is it's very much what you are, your evangel that you're out there preaching, Carolyn, which is relationships, love, old-fashioned business, standing by your word. It turns out those are really, really important to people, feeling emotionally like I can turn my back on you and feeling emotionally like even if I buy this at a premium, it will save money. It costs money because it saves money. Because people that are trustworthy are worth more money and they never go wanting for business. So I sort of have to earn my position on their roster of clients. When you can win the status of a trusted advisor, it is a very powerful, it's an economically beneficial place to be. So StoryFire capitalizes on this. Words are the most amazing thing ever invented. Persuasion is a magic trick that is worthy of a superhero. And the very easiest way to persuade someone is through stories, because stories help you feel understood. They help you register an argument emotionally and not just objectively. And they indicate this is someone who is reflecting a level of intelligence that I find stimulating, but trustworthy, because you don't want an investment banker. You don't want somebody watching your money that kind of doesn't get the punchline. Am I right? Mm. So much of the world is things we don't know we don't know. You need somebody to be able to swing with things that don't go like they're, you know, things that are, what's the word I'm looking for? Counterintuitive. So much of the world is counterintuitive. Can you imagine it's 17th century England and I have to persuade you that a little bit of the disease will keep you from getting the big disease?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine it's 18th century America and they're giving people smallpox vaccination by giving them cowpox? Who is going, you can't persuade them through an objective explanation. You just have to trust that the doctor has taken care of you his whole life. He wouldn't. This is why the Hippocratic Oath is a story. The Hippocratic Oath says it's a story about a person whose prime directive is that they will do no harm. So when I ask you to take this inoculation, understand to hurt you would be my prime. That would be the number one thing I would never do. Great brands are determined as much by what they won't do as what they will do. And you know, I'll bet you, Carolyn, that we could really distill down what you do in kind of one little phrase, which is the vast fortune of business is to be found in trust. That old fashioned business was the baker, the blacksmith, the water carrier. And you had to trust one another. Can you imagine being a cave person on the African plains and you are not trustworthy? What happens to you? You are dead by dawn. The tribe has to trust one another. And if you are not trustworthy, you will expire. That is for our own survival. Well, that graduated to, yes, but I do it because I love you, not because I fear you.
Mm.
If we're in this together, I just want to go on an editorial rant for just a second about affection.
Go on.
I knew this guy. He was, what was he? I think he was Saudi. Anyway, whenever he would drive, he would always let people in, you know, and he was a very courteous driver. And this is what he would do. Some jerk behind him was swerving around to get free, and he would go, "Oh, you're in a very big hurry, so I'll let you go." So he pulls by, and as the guy goes by, he's giving him the finger. You know, this guy who's like, "Hey, get out of the way!" Yeah. And his reaction was, "Oh, God bless you, God bless you, God bless you." And I thought, I don't know how you do that, but that's glorious, because the energy you're sending, despite he's hitting you with all this negativity and all this, "I'm the most important person on the road, and nobody matters but me." And your response is a heartfelt and genuine, "Oh, God bless you, God bless you." And he refuses to accept the gift of the negativity. He refuses to absorb the bile. And instead, he just radiates. I think I was the big winner, right? Because I got out of the car and I felt like I just learned something here. The indefatigable joy that guy went through life with. Was he Saudi? I don't know. I think it's,
it was an Irish accent. It sounded like an Irish accent to me.
You know what?
Top of the morning to you.
He would have been Black Irish.
Yeah, wow. Wow. And so you talked earlier about leaders and the energy they bring into a room.
Yeah.
And the energy that comes from them entering the room. And you know, you've talked about energy again just now. And beyond woo-woo, it's such a real thing. It is,
yeah,
you know.
I wish it wasn't. Yeah, because you and I both know on a quantum level, they have already confirmed that this is a fact, that quantum physics reveals that vibrations of energy, that is a string of energy that is vibrating at a certain frequency in concert with other strings of energy, is what forms matter. And it's really, there's nothing there. When you go down between molecules and then between atoms and then between the neutrinos and the quarks and the bosons, there's still physically nothing there. All it is it's magnetism, it's gravity. And so when the only reason that I can't pass my hand through this table is because the magnetic repulsions are keeping them away from one another. And that is vibrations of magnetic energy. So just like you, when you say the word woo-woo, it's like you have to say that so people will appreciate it. I'm talking about science. I'm not talking about, you know, some kind of tarot card thing. What I am saying is, you know perfectly well that some people have a gravitational pull. That just the very word attraction, like somebody is attractive, it is a magnetic gravitational pull. And then when somebody walks into a room and they radiate warmth, or they are, you know, that people are drawn to them, and that there is a real effect of energy that manifests in different ways. By the way, here's one of the more peculiar iterations of it. Odors are energy, just like everything else.
Yeah, right.
And it's true. They are everything. Even fire is just a radiations of vibrational energy. But I heard I'm not going to name her, but a very, very famous anthropologist and student of the human species confessed to me one time that relationships, that the fastest way to determine who will find somebody else attractive is by their body odor. And that the reason behind it is that you can, that subsonic or subconsciously we react to people's what do you call
pheromones?
No, well, pheromones are they are signatory to your immune system. They are an indicator. And you can, somebody can meet you and just discern your odor, and it tells them that you either do or don't have a complementary immune system. And it forms an attitude towards that person, either an attraction or a repulsion or a...
Wow.
And so the significance of this is that your body odors are, to an extent, almost controllable. That is, you by what you eat, by how much you exercise, it changes your aroma. And so that's just one of my little things that I think is that the things we don't understand about why we do things are so abundant that this is why I find what I do, you know, the storytelling as a skill is so important, because if you can captivate someone by giving them the sense that they are not alone in the world, that somebody else is having a similar experience, that you are a human being on this side of the transaction. And because you're a human being, there's a certain elasticity of how you treat others, a certain grace, a certain emotionality that means we're in this together, so we're not really opponents. And, you know, we do business together. We're not enemies. And I think that stories are an underappreciated mechanism. And I'll give you a great idea about like what I mean by a story. When I go into the hotel and Sandra greets me with this big smile, she's telling a story about how someone is happy to see you. Now, everybody walks around and their favorite subject is themselves. They are the heroes of their own movie. And when they meet somebody who is happy to see them, it's living up to their expectations of how their movie should go. When she pulls the prize spinner out and says, "Here, before you go," that she's telling me a story about, in my story, my favorite hotel person left me with a parting gift. In other words, storytelling isn't just saying this happened, then that happened, therefore this. It's not just that. It's how you conduct yourself in the world. You're telling a story. And if you are pleasant and rambunctious and playful with the waiter or the barista or the Uber driver or the hotel clerk, then what's happening is they're forming a story in their heads. You know, they're the star of their movie, but you are a character in their movie. And either you are a hero or a villain. Before they ship you off to basic training, a smart relative will tell you, make sure you treat the quartermaster and the food service people with great respect. And then you will never go hungry and you will always get your pay on time.
Neil, I love what you've just shared, and it's given me a thought that I'd never had before in this way, right? Which is every interaction you have is an opportunity to gift a story to someone. Story gifting, right?
You are a character in their movie.
Yeah.
And this is a chance for you to be the best part of their day. It's like, and you may have seen this. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but, you know, it's really hard to serve the general public. And the reason it's so hard is because even though they're not bad people, people walk around in bad moods and they'll have things that happen to them that spoiled their day. And now they're taking it out on you. And if you are a clerk in a hotel or a server in a restaurant, you can't very well respond. You know, you just sort of have to take your beating. But whenever you see somebody getting a hard time from a customer, what you can do for that server or that barista is you can wipe the slate clean of the damage. And the way you can do it is by being so funny and silly and so playful and positive that they remember you before they remember that.
Yes, let's all do that.
Right?
Let's all do that.
So if you ever witnessed to like somebody gave a server a hard time, then you, my friend Matt O'Mara, he used to do this all the time. He was so clever. He was, he loved treating service people, custodians, baggage handlers, loved treating them with special care and attention. Like, I see you, I notice you, I thank you for your job, and give you an idea about how he would do this. So we were at an auto show together, and we wanted to get into this presentation, but it was very popular. The speaker was incredibly popular. So we didn't get it. We got cut off just when they were that, you know, room had reached its limit. As we were walking away, Matt noticed these two gals with garbage pails, and they were trying to keep the floor of the auto show clean. And he picks up a piece of paper instead of letting them pick it up. He picks it up and he goes over to the cans, and then he's playing with them, like, which of the cans deserves this more? So he's having them do, like, try to see whose can wants this more. And they're all doing rock, paper, scissors. And it was very funny. And it was, it was cute. And they're making, he's making them laugh, which is his move. That's what he does. He makes everybody laugh. And ultimately what happened was this. The guy in security at the door of the auto show saw this interaction. And he was so impressed by how much Matt was making their day and making their job more pleasant that he's like, come here. And then he let us in. Because it's like, you know what? I'm not gonna leave that. No deed goes unpunished. Well, sometimes good deeds go unpunished. And it's a practice that I think we should all try to do, which is to at every opportunity, see if you can acknowledge someone. And
you know what? So I just want to go a bit deeper into this because I think it's so powerful because I feel like, you know, we go out into the world, you know, we leave school, university, whatever it might be, and we're really excited about, you know, the impact we're going to have in the world. But within a very short space of time, people feel this need to conform, to put on your suit, your conformity suit, and to hide who you really are, because God forbid, you don't want to stand out, right? And you know, you've got to fit into the factory settings of whatever organization you've turned up to, and, you know, do your time. It goes back to that you know, work is a slug. But we're doing ourselves such a disservice in not showing up as who we uniquely are, you know, and what matters to us, and being playful or passionate or whatever it might be. For a long time, you know, I've always, my background as well is marketing, 30 years agency side, and yet, despite being in the dark arts, I had a very strong sense of social justice. And you know, I remember moving back to Australia in 94, and, you know, and then had my daughter, and we'd go out to barbecues, my husband, my daughter and I. And I'm very interested in having political discussions and things like that. And my daughter and husband would say, can you just not, you know, can you just not corner someone? Because here in Australia, and maybe other parts of the world as well, you know, it's kind of like, nah, you don't want to be talking politics at a barbecue. People just don't like doing it. And this sense of kind of interest and activism I had, I always felt a little bit, not ashamed, but like I had to keep it at bay and hide it. Until I stepped into what I'm doing today, and the title I chose for myself was not CEO of my little micro company, which seems a bit silly anyway, but Chief Purpose Activist.
Mm-hmm.
And leaning into the activist part of me has changed everything, right? Mm. It's about, you know, taking off that suit of conformity, knowing that what I have to say and share, some people aren't going to like, and that's fine. They're not my people. But showing up with all the faults and, you know, mistakes I might make along the way, but it's me. It's me. What you see is what you get. And I found I am attracting like-minded people, and I am, you know, creating the kind of impact that I'm proud of. And I do feel way more fulfilled than I ever did. And as I've said a million times, I don't just love what I do, which is, you know, what I used to say in my marketing career, loving the skills I got to use. I'm doing what I love. And it's a huge difference in that. And that's your story, isn't it? It's you had a beautiful story recently about identity. Just recently you shared this story about what was it? I think you shared how you had an argument with someone in your agency, and you said something. You go.
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially it was that we had been having a discussion, and then the discussion moved to an argument, and then it moved to a full a real disagreement where I said something insulting. And as soon as the words left my mouth, I just thought, what an ass.
Douche waffle, I think you said.
Yeah, douche waffle, douche canoe. Anyway, I was so ashamed at having said it. And I thought, oh my God, I'll never live this down. Luckily, she said, do you really mean that? And I thought, oh my God, she's giving me a lifeline. And so, vociferously said, no, I'm so sorry. I did not mean that. It was a stupid thing to say, and I'm ashamed to have said it. Okay. And then subsequently we got along. Now, what was important was she had opened the door, or I should say left the door open for a human being to walk through instead of a jerk. And because, what typically will happen is when somebody insults you, you immediately, you react in defense. So you are either just as hostile in return, or you disconnect and disengage and so forth. But she gave me what I referred to in the story as the Pygmalion effect, which is when you set a high standard, when you expect good things out of people, they will often live up to your expectation. And they've demonstrated this again and again with students and soldiers and police officers and so forth, is that when you set a standard of behavior and expect people to live up to that standard, they will. And she granted me enough grace to say, gee, that's not like you. Do you want to try a mulligan? You want to do that again? And then I was so grateful. Now, here was the unexpected dividend. I think that she was the big winner there, because not because I apologized, it was deserved, but because my estimation of her as a person went skyrocketed. I thought, what a clever and gracious and intelligent thing to do just then. Not react out of anger, but give me a chance to try again. And let's see if we can't apply that in our own lives. Okay, so what would it be an example? A loved one says something that's hurtful, but you don't react by giving them as good as you got. You just say, wow, that really hurt my feelings. Did you mean to say that? Mm-hmm. Or you're in an office environment and somebody says something that upsets you. Instead of in a public way making an announcement, you can just very calmly in a private time say, hey, can I tell you that really had this effect on me? I don't know if you're aware of it, but that really hurt my feelings. And you give them a chance to recover their humanity.
Rather than complaining to someone else.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And again, as I was saying before with Sandra, it's like the shower head was busted, but I didn't complain. I informed because she had already established that she was my friend. So, I'm not here to bust her balls. I just want to see if I can get this fixed. And that to me was that's a lesson. And you know what happened, Carolyn? I blew it again. Just about 4 days ago, I did it again. I said something stupid. And luckily they gave me a chance to back away. But we're all subject to, tempers. Mm. And I'm trying to get better. I suppose as long as we're trying.
That's the clincher, isn't it? Is constantly trying to get better. Your stories are beautiful. I mean, I only came across you, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago. No, maybe a year ago on LinkedIn. And I don't know how long you've been doing that for, but I could see this sudden surge in interest, and the messages in your stories are messages of kindness, humanity, hope, just beautiful, beautiful messages. And, on a platform like LinkedIn, it is such a joy to not just to see those stories and those messages, but to see the impact. Like, we get to actually see the impact it's having on people by the comments.
Yeah.
On your LinkedIn posts. And where has that come from? Like, your background, creative marketing background, agency background.
Yeah. I'll tell you what the origin of the whole thing is. is that Australia is suffering from the same problem we have in the States, which is that there are whole networks devoted to encouraging rage, because rage is engagement and it locks people's attention, and it's profitable to enrage people and divide them. Unfortunately, it's also it's psychopathic to do such a thing. I don't know how these people sleep at night, but there are whole platforms on the web whose very existence depends on people enraging one another. And I just wanted to be the antidote to that. And my form of it was, this is my experience in my real life. This isn't you concocting some disaster at some corner of the world and then making it my problem. This isn't me foisting a steady diet of ridiculous, dim-witted people saying and doing stupid things just to make me upset. Instead, I'm going to tell you about my experience, which is, for the most part, pretty good. 90% of the people I've met are pretty cool, and they have their off days, okay, but 90% of the time, they're pretty cool. I'll give you an example. You're driving, and some jerk cuts you off or flips you off or does something else that is, you know, can really ruin your drive. Well, just look around you. How many cars are surrounding you and have passed you going in the other direction? It's thousands, thousands and thousands. And there's one jerk? You're looking at this wrong. You should be celebrating the miracle that we are all getting along as well as we are. The percentage of badness is so small, but the human character isolates on the bad. You'll hear this again and again, by the way, from stand-up comedians. They'll have a terrific set, and then one joke bombed, and they're pissed. They walk off the stage going, oh, damn it. Or somebody heckled them or something. You know, never mind that everybody had a wonderful time. It is the human condition to fixate on the one thing that didn't go right. Well, I'm trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to deliver my personal experience of occasions that I've had that are sometimes funny and sometimes touching. And the beauty of it is, I'm really shocked at how many times there was like a twist ending in my life. I'll tell you one story if we've got time for it.
Please.
It just kills me, because this was the real thing. So it was one of these days where if you told me I was going to have a wonderful day at the end of it, I would have said, no, not a chance. I woke up in the morning, had a very long drive. I wasn't making any money at the time. And I had one business suit for this job that I had. My car was a Ford Mustang that didn't have a hood. And if it would rain, oftentimes the car would have electrical problems for obvious reasons, right? It just got inundated. Well, one morning I wake up and sure enough, the car won't function and I need somebody to fix it. So this was back in the days of phone books and checks. You know, you have to write a check and consult the phone book looking for garages. So I called all around looking for someplace that I could afford. And what the bad news was that everybody was like going to charge me $200 just to tow it in, you know, to say nothing of the actual work. Finally, I found this little ad, a little tiny Yellow Pages ad that said something like Balkan Auto Repair Garage Business. And so I call them up and they say, yes, no problem. We can fix that for you. No problem. And then I said, well, but would you be able to tow me? Can you do that? And he goes, no problem. I'll send my father. So this 90-year-old guy shows up, and I'm pretty sure he's new to tow trucks. And the truck he's driving looks like it's missing some pretty important parts. But he's got this beautiful head of ice cream white hair. It looks like if Elvis had white hair. And he was, like I say, he was kind of new to tow trucks. So I had to help him hook the car up. And in the process, it mangled my suit and got my suit all grease stained. And normally, this would have sent me into a fury. But instead, he was just so sunny and funny and adorable in his way. I couldn't help it. I just thought it was, okay, you know what? Okay, so the suit got wrecked. A big deal. We'll survive this. Okay, now he's got some Armenian folktale playing on the radio, and he's dancing in his seat and trying to teach it to me. By the time we arrive, I'm in a good mood. Now, four generations of his family go to work on the car like a F1 pit crew. And the only person that I've met in the entire crew who is sour of disposition is the woman running the place, and she's behind the desk, and she is has the sense of humor of a German razor blade. So she's looking at me very distrustful, and all she wants to persuade me of is, you know, they'd better get this finished soon, quick, because we close at noon. And I'm like, okay. But I'm infected with this positivity by the old guy that I'm trying to get her to smile. So I'm telling her jokes, and I'm turning pencils into puppets and doing everything I can think of. And she's having none of it. Eventually, they fix the car. Beautiful job. It rolls up. It's running like a top. And I'm thinking, oh God, now here comes the bill. And she says, it was more expensive than we thought it was going to be. And I'm like, oh, now the gypsies are going to have their way. And she goes, they gave me an estimate of $92, and it was $94. And so I'm in ecstasy. And I pull out my checkbook and I'm looking for, you know, who do I make this out to? Is it really Balkan Auto Repair Garage? And I look behind the German razor blade, and there is an enormous sign that I am only seeing for the first time that says no checks.
Oh.
So I look into her humorless eyes for some glimmer of mercy that is not there. And then the old guy walks in with a little infant in his arms. And the baby has the identical head of hair to the old man, except it's jet black. And the baby and I lock eyes. And it looks at me and it goes, whoo! Ha! And then it squeals in delight. And the old guy goes, he knows you from before in the other life. And the woman behind the counter, no smile, goes, well, if he knows you, it checks okay.
I love that.
That happened just as I described. And when she said that, I was absolutely over the moon. Now, here's a footnote. The reason they were closing at noon was they were having some kind of crazy family reunion or something. And they had been cooking in the back, even as they were working on my car. And she is getting ready to close the gate, you know. And she says to me, we're closing for lunch. You hungry? And I just went, I'm staying for the lemon.
And it would have been amazing. I know my husband's from the Balkans, and the food is unbelievable.
They make these delicious pastries that have lamb in them, and they're like, they'll have them for breakfast, and they're just glorious. I don't know what kind of coffee they drink in the Balkans, but, you know, Greek coffee, Turkish coffee is incredibly strong. So I assume Albanian coffee and Montenegrin coffee is probably pretty hardcore.
It's the same. Greek, Turkish, Montenegrin, all the same. Neil, you're, I don't even want to wrap this up, but I want to really pull out a message around stories, because the minute people start talking about storytelling, I think they tend to land on marketing, brand stories.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's a marketing department's area. And yet we live, we share, we're constantly sharing stories. You know, when we talk to our friends, it's an expression of our identity. It's how we connect with people, you know, whether playfully.
It's the human operating system. It is the hard part. They've been doing it for 30,000 years. For 30,000 years, they know for a fact we've been telling tales about what will happen tomorrow and what happened in the past. And it is the human operating system. And I would say, it is not the province of the marketing department. It is the domain of the chief executive officer.
Mm.
It is the vision for the future. It is the belief in their people. It is communicating love, affection, understanding, making people feel understood. You don't do, by the way, you know, a comedian comes into a room and says, I'm very funny. You know what that's like? That's like a CEO coming in and saying, we're like a family here. You know, like, it is completely not believable. And I'm not sure what a great comedian will do is walk into the room and immediately start being funny. There was this wonderful joke that Steve Martin used to tell. He walked out on stage and he said, I was at the cathedral in Chartres, France, at this glorious Gothic cathedral, unbelievable scale, gorgeous architecture. It was a phenomenon. And as I was painting my name on it in spray paint, and the audience, of course, erupts in laughter because he had wrong-footed them. He'd taken this down this, like, well, we're about to hear about this glorious thing only to be, you know, he's desecrating the very monument. He's demonstrating that he's funny. He's not telling you he's funny. Well, a chief executive officer that walks into the room and explains a challenge they're having or a goal they achieved. And what the CEO is going to want to do is say, I want to tell you about this goal. And instead of telling you all the wonderful things that happened, I want to tell you how many times we came close to disaster. And then I want to give you the names of the people who saved us. This happened and this happened. Now, this is a story saying this happened on this date and then blah, blah, and then this shut down. If it had stayed shut down for one more half hour, it would have been our doom. But Janet came from baby in arm, came to the headquarters and got this system running again. So let's all have a round of applause for the, you know, the what would we, you know, for Saint Janet of Le Bébé. Okay, that's what a CEO is, ought to be, the greatest teller of stories. So that what happens is, he doesn't just celebrate the triumphs of the business, and he certainly doesn't pat himself on the back for having achieved some metric. Instead, what he does is he infuses the culture with belief that this is someone I want to follow. You tell me to do something, I will do it because I want to, because I believe in you. And why do I believe in you? Because I am getting the signal you care about us. And so stories are a CEO providing a vision and a warm, safe place for people to be their best selves, for them to think of the new ideas because they're not terrified of losing their job tomorrow. And it's the province of the CFO, who anybody can add up numbers, and some people can help people add up numbers, and some people can help other people add up bigger teams of numbers. And some people know what the numbers mean, and the best CFOs know where their numbers are going. But that's a fiction until you bring it to life in a story. A CFO ought to be a storyteller to tell you where the numbers are headed. And a salesperson absolutely should be a great storyteller so that they can say, I hear you, I see you, I understand your pain, I know the experience you're having. May I present you with a possibility here that might be the best thing to happen to you all year? I think this could change your life. Let me describe what happened to a customer of mine before. It's a story about someone who, it was a real stretch for them to afford this, but it's the one thing they point to again and again about how to make an investment in a product. So it's not just us sitting around at the water cooler and gossiping. It is presenting a human being's perspective on what we're doing.
Beautiful. Show, don't tell, stories over facts. I think to go beyond what you've gone talked about with the CEO, the CFO, the salesperson, to me, the hallmark of the most successful stories who know who they are, they've got a clear identity on who the best of them are the organizations whose own people are sharing everyday stories, you know, of who they are in action. And
a great storyteller will have a perspective. They'll have a point of view. They'll have values. So let's go back to what you were saying, Carolyn, about your own journey. And, you know, you are finding your tribe and you're unafraid about being who you are. And that's a perspective. That's a strong, definitive viewpoint. And when you share it out into the world, it comes back to you. And yeah, a leader that is all things to all people is nothing to anyone. And I want to say something that I often say in periods like this, which is leaders define themselves as much by what they won't do as what they'll do. And Great, great historical figures are defined by what they won't do. And in the States, we just went through a traumatic election, traumatic because people were trying to disturb the momentum of a long Democratic tradition. And there was at least one person standing in the way, saying, as much as I would like to for this to be true, it isn't, and therefore I will not do what you want me to do. And that will define that person for the rest of their lives, what they wouldn't do.
Yeah.
It's something they're never going to be ashamed of. Absolutely. For the rest of their life.
Absolutely.
And great stories will help us communicate that, you know, the things we won't do.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Neil, I have thoroughly enjoyed this discussion with you.
Me too, Claire.
I hope you will come back another time and
oh, sure.
regale us with more stories. I'd like to invite you to close out this episode by sharing Neil's dream, you know, the work you're doing today through StoryFire, through the content you share. A few years from now,
yeah,
if it could achieve what you hope, what would that look like?
What I want to do is I have been invited by many people across the country, in the States, who have said, and people in Australia and Ireland for that matter, because they've seen my stories, they say, hey, if you're ever in Duluth, Minnesota, or if you're ever in Raleigh, North Carolina, do me a favor, just let me know. I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee. And I had this dream of sort of crossing the country, never paying for my own coffee. And that's changed a little bit. And here's my new dream. I believe that small business is the hope for the future, not big business. Big business gets all the headlines, and you know the billionaires are all, they get all the ink, and the private jets and the excess and all of that crapola. When it's really small businesses based on relationships, based on keeping promises, people who are careful about each other because they work with each other directly. I want to tell the story of American small business. I want to travel the country and help them tell their stories. And I want to do it sort of like Anthony Bourdain would do when he would go from restaurant to restaurant, because it's everything I believe in. It's relationships, truth-telling, values, old-fashioned trade, business in its best sense, people taking care of each other. And I want to tell that story because I believe ultimately what's going to happen is we will all yearn to work for small companies again. We won't participate in this rapacious, this churning, robotic, all-consuming need for constant growth, you know, while sacrificing everything in the face of a higher stock price so that you can buy another vacation home and a bigger jet. That I think small business might wind up being our salvation.
Beautiful. Thank you, Neil. Pleasure to have you.
Back at you, Carolyn. This has been fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?